We are gathered here today, not to mourn, but to pay tribute to the memory and the legacy of Global Force Wrestling. I know. I'd like to thank all six of you for being here today. Had we done a better job of advertising this, perhaps we could have had eight or nine. Old habits die hard. And while you may be asking, how is it possible for a company to establish a legacy after just 3 years in existence, with no television, running only half-empty minor league baseball stadiums? Well, I really don't have a good answer for you. But I was given this gold bar and a free ticket to Universal Orlando to officiate this thing, so here we are. But there can be no doubt that Global Force Wrestling...
Force.
Global Force Wrestling blazed a trail of mediocrity and disappointment in its short run that would make even Herb Abrams blush. Still, though, there are memories that will last a lifetime, like that one time that, well, who can forget the night that, you know, he won the championship? Man, he was a great champion. Or how about those TV tapings that'll never see the light of day because half the roster is now under contract to WWE? Global Force was so successful, WWE could only compete by stealing many of its big stars. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is really why we are all here today, to pay homage to Jeff Jarrett's Global Force.
Force.
In fact, I've taken the liberty to prepare a special haiku for the occasion. Global Force start strong, but then Impact come along. Made offer, now we're gone.
That's six syllables.
Thank you. And so let us bow our heads in silent shame and remember the good times, whatever they may have been. Okay, who wants to go eat pizza and play skee-ball?
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Karen Jarrett announced on Impact this week that Global Force Wrestling has officially merged with Impact Wrestling. Jeff Jarrett finally got that TV deal he's been waiting for, only took him 3 years to get it. I don't really see the point, unless they're adopting the GFW name, which it does not look like they are doing. I guess they're still defending the GFW belts, but I think it's safe to quit pretending that this is any sort of actual wrestling company at this point. They still have Shelton Benjamin on the GFW roster, if you go on their website. I bet that's news to him. And to Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Chael Sonnen. Yes, Chael Sonnen is listed on the GFW website as a member of its roster. I would take Chael over Josh Matthews on commentary any day of the week. That'd be a huge upgrade. By the way, Impact settled one of the lawsuits against them from last year, one of the many, many lawsuits against them. Audience of One Productions had sued them for $223,000 for breaching a contract by not paying them for services that they had provided. Well, Impact admitted that they did in fact breach their deal, and they have agreed to pay $336,000 in damages. So they're finally paying production people. See, we're making progress here. This is episode 492 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, April 23rd, 2017. I am the Solid Monster. You guys are killing it this month with our Audible link. We're only one sign up away, as I checked this morning, for making this our third best month ever on Audible. We have another week to make that happen. And remember, you sign up using our link, you get to try the service free for 30 days, and you get a free audiobook of your choosing. Obviously, the popular one right now seems to be AJ Lee's Crazy Is My Superpower. It's listed on there under AJ Mendez. You can get the book right now, audibletrial.com/Solid Monster. Of course, you can also get The Death of WCW, The Daniel Bryan book is still a hot choice on there, and lots of other ones. And you get it free, courtesy of the Sound Of. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Again, AJ narrates her own book, as does Daniel Bryan, for those of you who are interested in that. Shout out to Julian Cannon. He sent me a photo rocking a Sound Off shirt with CM Punk at the Chicago Comic Expo. You can get your picture taken, you know, wearing a Sound Off shirt with a wrestler, or even without one. Easy way to get a retweet. So if you do have those photos to share, by all means, tweet them to me. You can go to prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. If you want to buy a shirt. Thanks also to Julian for having me on his show, The Wrestling Court, on Friday night. You can become a PayPal VIP very easily by going to thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal donate button on the right-hand side of the page. That is the place to go if you would like to support the podcast in the form of a PayPal donation. $10 or more will get your wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this show. I want to say thank you. As we do a roll call here this week real quick. John Loose Cannon Lopez, you are the man, as is Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, The Philly Fanatic, Caliph Kane, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, The Marietta Mahler, Alexandru Mata, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Massgrave Micah Harshaw, Raymond the Mountie Medina, The Bakersfield Brawler Kevin Velato, The Prince of Pleasantville, Emilio Crockett, Tyler the Boss Williams, happy 20th to him, The Dark Serpent, Derek Gibbs, The Scottish Assassin, Colin Kayer, Scorpion Scott Kina, Diesel-powered Anthony Mitchell, The Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, Real Rock and Roller, Ryan Hodge, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Capital Carnage, Christian Reyes, Jagged, Josh O'Neill, Christian the Vampire Vasquez, Joe War Machine Warring, and Pipe Bomb Preston Marquis. Thank you very much. Hey, today is also John Cena's 40th birthday. Old man Cena. Vince McMahon on Twitter calling him the Babe Ruth of WWE. Which is funny because he actually called Hulk Hogan the Babe Ruth of WWE a few years ago on Twitter. So apparently there's multiple Babe Ruths. There's only one Babe Ruth in WWE. It is Hulk Hogan. Although I'd be curious what you guys think. Who do you think is the Babe Ruth of WWE? Again, my vote goes to Hogan. Vince, though, you know, he's getting up there in years, so maybe a little bit of that selective memory going on here. But I remember his Vanilla Ice phase like it was yesterday. They grow up so fast. But in more serious news, unfortunately, we do have to start, and I hate doing this, but we have to, with some sad news, another wrestler death here in 2017. It feels like we've had way too many, and we're not even out of April yet. Matt Anoa'i, best known as Rosie, son of WWE Hall of Famer Sika, and older brother of Roman Reigns, died on Monday, just 10 days removed from his 47th birthday. No cause of death has been released yet, but he did suffer from congestive heart failure and AFib, which is an irregular heartbeat condition, can put you at greater risk for heart attack, among many other things. I know all too well about that because my grandmother had the exact same thing. His weight was said to have ballooned up to around 450 pounds. He was not in great shape physically. Somebody had just posted maybe a week ago in our Facebook group. I guess he did a Facebook Live video. He recorded it in his car. He was talking about how the fans should lay off booing his brother and that sort of thing and answering fan questions. He had three young kids who now have no father. That's the worst part of all this. Just terrible news. He came into WWE, if you remember, as part of 3-Minute Warning. That was really his big break there. It was Rosie and Jamal. Jamal being Eddie Fatu, who would go on to become Umaga a few years later. So both members now of 3-Minute Warning are gone. Neither of them making it to their 50th birthday. It was a memorable gimmick, you know. They were Eric Bischoff's hired henchmen back when Bischoff was the Raw GM. He would give somebody a 3-Minute Warning, and then out would come these giant Samoan, hitmen to beat the crap out of somebody. One of the most memorable angles in SmackDown history was the Billy and Chuck wedding. That was when Bischoff, he had the prosthetics on. Remember, he was dressed up as the minister, and he did the big reveal. It was really well done, and 3-minute warning came out. They beat up Billy, they beat up Chuck, they gave Stephanie McMahon a Samoan drop. The entire roster then came out to run them off because they were Raw guys invading SmackDown. That was back when that actually meant something. But then Jamal got fired not long after that. Rosie was kind of left out on his own. He ended up becoming a tag team with the Hurricane, and that got over pretty well. He became a superhero in training, which was a nice little rib on him. He had the initials SHIT. How witty of them. But he got over as a fan favorite. They even won the tag team titles briefly. They rehired Jamal a few years later. I believe they wrestled a dark match together. They were going to reform 3-Minute Warning, but Vince McMahon, I guess, saw monster heel potential in Jamal and decided to break him off as Umaga. And that pretty much spelled the end of Rosie's run in WWE. He never did come back. He never had, I don't even think he did any cameos. I don't think we ever saw him again. He kept wrestling on the indies. I know he was running his own promotion down in Florida with his father. So, condolences to the Anoa'i family. This is not the first time they've lost a member of that family young. Yokozuna was a member of that clan. He died a few weeks after his 34th birthday. Now, they did air a graphic for Rosie before SmackDown on Tuesday. I mean, I would have been stunned had they not, given his, you know, relationship to the biggest star in the company. Umaga, they never acknowledged after he died. And Umaga had only been out of the company for maybe a year when he passed away. Maybe less than a year. Which I can only assume it was because of the nature in which he passed away. But that was still, I always thought that was still pretty rotten of them not to say anything and just kind of pretend like the guy didn't exist. Of course, now on commentary, you've got them name-dropping Umaga here and there. Oh, what a great athlete Umaga was. But there was a period there where he was persona non grata, kind of in that company, it felt like. But at least Rosie, they did acknowledge. Speaking of SmackDown, I want to talk about SmackDown first this week. We'll kind of change up the formula a little bit here because there's a lot of SmackDown-related news to get into, starting with Mauro Ranallo. Mauro Ranallo has reached a settlement agreement of some sort with WWE. So Mauro getting the Fox News treatment. According to Dave Meltzer, Newsweek had been working on a major story about the whole Mauro JBL situation, and WWE wanted to put this thing to bed as quickly as possible. They reached a deal. They reached out on their own to Newsweek to give them quotes from Mauro and from JBL. Or at least Mauro maybe on his own emailed them and gave them a quote. But this is what Mauro had to say to Newsweek. A very brief quote. He said, WWE and I have mutually agreed to part ways. It has nothing to do with JBL. Isn't that interesting? And JBL had this to say, clearly in a very prepared statement. I'm pretty good at spotting these things. I've written enough of them myself, working in PR and having done crisis stuff to know what they look like. But this is what he said. He said, admittedly, I took part in locker room pranks that existed within the industry years ago. WWE addressed my behavior and I responded accordingly. Yet my past is being brought up because of recent unfounded rumors. I apologize if anything I said playing a bad guy on a TV show was misconstrued. End quote. So, Mauro took the money in exchange for keeping quiet. I think it's pretty obvious that's what's happening here. I'm sure there's a gag on him, too, as far as talking about this in the future. At least, if WWE were smart in working out a settlement, they would have that written into whatever the agreement is. And, you know, to each their own. You know, you do what you gotta do. Sometimes in life, you gotta read between the tea leaves, and this is one of those times, okay? Now, if we play devil's advocate and we say, well, you know, JBL was completely innocent and he was just a perfect little angel, then I guess Mauro Ranallo is the world's worst broadcast partner because he could have come out weeks ago and said, look, guys, I don't want to talk about what's going on or I can't talk about what's going on. My doctor told me not to talk about what's going on. Please respect my privacy, but John had nothing to do with this, okay? So leave him out of it. And that would have been very quick and easy for him to do. Not only did he not do that, he let his MMA friends and all these other people go on social media and basically threaten JBL and make him out to be this awful, rotten human being. And once Mauro started to reemerge on social media, he posted a whole bunch of passive-aggressive tweets, right? Passive-aggressive tweet after passive-aggressive tweet that were obviously directed at JBL. He let it fester, which, you know, could have turned into a big public relations nightmare for WWE. I mean, the story had started to gain some traction. There were some stories about it, but this could have really blew up in their face. Not just for JBL, but for the company as a whole. So, you know, in the case of JBL, we're now supposed to believe that he didn't have anything to do with any of this. Okay, well, all I can say is I hope Mauro invests his money wisely. Let's talk about Jinder Mahal. Jinder Mahal. Who would have thought that Jinder Mahal would be a major story this week? But he is. This is the same Jinder Mahal who has not won a match on television in probably 6 months before this past week. He will challenge Randy Orton for the WWE Championship in a pay-per-view main event. He won a six-pack challenge on SmackDown over Sami Zayn, Luke Harper, Eric Rowan, Dolph Ziggler, and Mojo Rawley to become number one contender at the Backlash pay-per-view on May 21st. A full 4 weeks away. Can you believe it? I mean, what am I going to do all those weeks in between without a pay-per-view to watch? Well, actually, there is a pay-per-view, I guess, next Sunday. It's a Raw pay-per-view, but it's got Randy Orton on there, so he's a SmackDown guy. I guess that counts. And it looks like he may no longer be defending his championship on that show, by the way, against Bray Wyatt. It may now be a non-title match. I know the original graphic they showed indicated that it was a WWE Championship match, this House of Horrors thing. Now it may not be. I can only assume it's because Bray got drafted over to Raw, and it really wouldn't make any sense to have a Raw guy wrestling for a SmackDown title. Now, if it is non-title, that's actually good news for Bray, because it means he could finally win a match. There's no reason for Randy Orton to beat him again. Sami Zayn had Jinder lined up with a Huluva kick. The Bollywood Boys from the Cruiserweight Classic, remember them? They reached in, they grabbed Sami's feet. Jinder came over, Cobra Clutch into a slam, and that was it. That was enough to get the pin, and thus Jinder became number one contender. We never saw or heard from the Bollywood Boys again after that. It certainly seems like they will be aligned with Jinder going forward, which I actually like. That aspect of this I like. It's one way, you know, you think about how can we put heat on this guy besides the fact that he's got brown skin, because you know WWE's relied on that before. Oh, this guy looks like a foreigner. He looks like a terrorist. He looks like this. He looks like that. Let's make him a heel, right? How many freaking years has WWE done this sort of thing? Let's put that garbage aside for a second. How else can we get heat on this guy, right? And make people hate him? Well, it's very simple. You give him a pair of lackeys to do their dirty work. That's one way to put heat on somebody. Bollywood Boys weren't doing anything anyway, so why not, right? He got big heat for the win. I do wonder if that was more for the shock or the disappointment in the outcome than anything else. Now, if it carries over into this week, we'll know maybe that they've got something here. But people have just been heavily divided on this. You know, half of you seem to be in the whole this is a joke camp. The other half are in the, well, you know, it's something new, and you people always complain about wanting somebody new, then you get them and all you do is complain camp, right? There's two distinct camps here. I look at it like this. There's a little bit of good and a little bit of bad here. Is it ridiculous that Jinder Mahal is wrestling for the world title? You bet your ass it is. It is preposterous. Is this the first time we've seen something like this? No, it's not. If you want to hop back in the Wayback Machine, you go all the way back to 2004. And this is the example a lot of you have emailed into me, and you're absolutely right. Bradshaw, the aforementioned JBL who I just got done talking about, he went from having, you know, a beer in one hand to a book. Suddenly one week he turned into J.R. Ewing, this guy. Lucky for him, he had Eddie Guerrero to work with. He and Eddie were good friends. And Eddie went out of his way to make the whole thing work. He made it his objective to make JBL a success story. And I think Eddie Guerrero, as much as anybody, had a lot to do with JBL getting over as well as he did. And I think that bloodbath they had at that Judgment Day pay-per-view also did a lot to help JBL. That friggin' match was a war. But that's an example of where it worked. Now, Jinder is even lower on the totem pole than Bradshaw was back then. But the situation is similar. They needed a heel to challenge for the championship, and so they made a new star because they had to. Now, I don't see the same thing happening here, but they're going to try. At least for a month, they're going to give it a shot, even if it is just to kill some time. If they give him one or even two pay-per-view matches before they do, you know, Orton and Corbin or Orton and AJ maybe for SummerSlam. But the biggest difference here is that back then, they were in a position in 04 where they didn't really have anybody else. They were in a pinch. I think Kurt was injured and maybe there were some other people who were injured. They needed to make a guy. They were forced to make somebody new and they did. The difference is today, you look at the roster, you look at who they have in NXT, they have lots and lots of talented, capable people who could fill that role, including two people in that six-pack challenge on Tuesday, okay? Sami Zayn and Luke Harper. And instead, they chose to go with a guy who they've booked as a joke. They've booked this guy as an afterthought. So SmackDown is either the land of opportunity, as they love to say, or the place that gets Raw's sloppy seconds. Right, we have the colognes. The colognes couldn't cut it on Raw, so they went to SmackDown. Jinder couldn't cut it on Raw, so he goes to SmackDown, and he gets a title shot. Right, but not before losing to Mojo Rawley first. Remember that, he lost to Mojo on his, I think his first match on SmackDown. Now, I have no agenda against Jinder. I stuck up for the guy on last week's podcast when people were beating him up over the Finn Balor concussion. But he was clearly brought back to put other people over. So it's quite the leap to suddenly take this guy seriously as a number one contender. I can see why people would roll their eyes at this. Now, as ridiculous as this whole thing is, I would be lying if I said there wasn't at least a part of me that hopes he does win the championship from Randy Orton. Now, he won't. I'll put that out there. But I kind of hope he does, because babyface champion Randy Orton so far, you know, and I said this on Twitter, he's about as interesting as a ball of earwax. It's just, now, I think Orton and AJ will be really great when they eventually get to it, but right now, with Orton, ever since he turned on Bray, it's just been brutal. It's been absolutely brutal. At least Jinder with the Bollywood boys. You know what? If it works, if it catches on, that could be something. You know, stranger things have happened. But this is hardly the first time somebody at his level was given a world title match. You know, you had R-Truth wrestling John Cena a few years ago. Bob Holly. Bob Holly won more matches than Jinder has. He was higher up in the pecking order than Jinder. But I had Dave Lagana. Dave Lagana was on the podcast a few months ago. He was a WWE writer for SmackDown when Bob was on the show back in the day. And he said, you know, we tried. We tried with Bob Holly. But at least there, they had a backstory. Lesnar broke Holly's neck the year before. Holly came back. He was out for a long, long time. And he went for revenge. And so, yeah, I'm sure it was a leap even then for people to buy into Bob Holly against Brock Lesnar on pay-per-view. You know, at the Royal Rumble that one year for the championship. But there was a built-in story there. And I think that could have worked. That could have worked better than it did. But they tried. So, you know, with Jinder now, they've got 4 weeks, okay, that's a month, to get me excited for this as a championship match. I said this, I was on Julian Cannon's podcast the other night. Sometimes all it takes is one really great promo or one great contract signing segment, and who knows, maybe he'll win everybody over. Maybe he will. I only wish, I get the whole surprise factor. Oh, we surprised everybody. You know, people are only upset because the person they didn't, you know, that they liked didn't win and all that nonsense. But to go from 0 to 60 like that, to go from chapter 3 of the book to chapter 33, you know, they fancy themselves storytellers. They need to do a better job of that. And maybe they'll fill those gaps in over the next 4 weeks. But that's what I didn't like about it. It's like, all of a sudden, I'm supposed to buy into this. You gotta put the work in to convince me. You know, it's not my job to be convinced. It's your job to convince me as the viewer. And, you know, at least in my case, I'm willing to give it a shot. But, you know, they have not done that. They've done a poor job of that. And they've got 4 weeks, so we'll see what they have up their sleeve. I have a little more faith, given that it's SmackDown and not Raw, that they may be able to do that. We'll find out. I did think this was an interesting quote. I wanted to put this in here. This was an interesting quote from Sean Waltman, this week of all weeks. And this is kind of part of the other issue I have with this, but this is also part of a bigger issue that goes beyond Jinder Mahal. Sean Waltman was on Kevin Undergaro's show. He has a podcast or a YouTube show. So he was a guest on there, and he was talking about the importance of winning matches in WWE, which, you know, in the case of Jinder, he certainly hasn't done very much of. But this is what Sean Waltman said. He said, "You're taught you're a mark if you don't like to lose. If you question doing a job for somebody, wins and losses do matter. They effing do matter. That whole, it doesn't matter if you win or lose shit, they say that when it's convenient. Sorry, but that's just how I feel about it." And I'm with Waltman in that. Okay, as a fan, now he may be coming from that as a performer, you know, wins and losses mattering or not mattering. As a fan, as a viewer, I want to believe that wins and losses matter. Because at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of things that go into the entertainment part of the product. It's not just about, you know, the fake matches and who wins and who loses. But at the end of the day, you have a ring and there's matches that determine who is supposed to be important and who is not so important. Right? At its core, that's what wrestling, that's what WWE still is. They can call it whatever they want to. That's what it is. And I'm happy he called them out on that nonsense. You know, I hear these WWE people sometimes, they're on social media, they're arguing with people, wins and losses don't matter, it's not about wins and losses. You know what, tell that to Hogan, tell that to Warrior, tell that to Steve Austin and all the other guys who became megastars over the years, in part because they won most of their matches. They were treated like a big deal. And this is part of a larger point. Again, I'm not trying to apply this to Jinder. I'm not putting Jinder in that same camp. But it's just common sense that if you want people to take a guy seriously, okay, to pay to see them or what have you, you've got to treat them like a somebody. Now, those guys I just mentioned, the Hogans and the Austins and even the Cenas, you could throw him in there. Besides the winning, I mean, those guys had a ton of charisma. I mean, those guys could talk people into the buildings. They had something special that not everybody has. But they were winners. They won way more than they lost. You ever wonder why there's no megastars anymore in WWE? I can't tell you how many emails I get from time to time. Still, you know, over the last few years, asking me, how come WWE hasn't found the next Steve Austin? Why is it so hard? What's so different now as compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago? Why are there no more megastars in WWE? Because Roman Reigns is their top guy. I wouldn't consider him a megastar at the level of those other guys, at least not yet. You know, maybe one day Vince will get his wish and he'll get there, but he ain't no megastar. AJ Styles is fantastic. He's not a megastar. Brock Lesnar is the closest thing to a megastar that they have. I don't want to hear that wins and losses don't matter. I think Waltman hit the nail right on the head. It's a convenient excuse for them to use, but it's BS. SmackDown Twitter poll. Over 2,300 votes, 62% thumbs up, 38% thumbs down. Besides the six-pack challenge, which was positioned in the middle of the show, by the way, AJ Styles is still main eventing on this show. He's still headlining, as he should be. I am not convinced that Randy Orton and Jinder Mahal is actually going to headline, like end Backlash. I bet you that Kevin Owens and AJ for the U.S. title is the match that goes on last. We had Charlotte beating Naomi in a non-title match with her natural selection finish to earn a shot at the SmackDown Women's Championship. Quicker than I thought. Boy, they're not wasting any time with this. Same with Alexa Bliss on Raw. She's challenging for the Raw Women's title next Sunday at Payback. It's a race to see who can become the first woman to hold each title from Raw and SmackDown. I got my money on Charlotte. How could I not? You know they can't wait to add another accomplishment to the list for her that they can cram down our throats and burn into our brain every single week. I am tempted to go with Alexa, if only because they are in San Jose next Sunday, which is Bayley's hometown. And you know how much they love to bend people over and do unspeakable things to them in their hometown. But this time I'm going to say Charlotte gets there first. Then they can build to a Charlotte-Becky Lynch match for SummerSlam. Primo and Epico, the Colons, beat American Alpha, the Colones. I know, I'm sorry. Sunset flip spot, Primo kicked Jason Jordan in the head, and Epico rolled him up for the pin. Kind of a weak finish. The kick didn't look very good. They tried to do some kind of weird edit, it almost looked like, to make it look better. I'm trying to remember where I saw it. Somebody floated the idea of bringing in Carlito to pair off with Primo and Epico, which is what I suggested they do when they first tried pushing those two, like, over a year ago. I said, if they don't bring in Carlito, these two are dead in the water. And we all see how well that worked out. My understanding is they did reach out to Carlito, he just didn't want to come in. I mean, who could blame him? Anyway, one of you suggested bringing in Carlito to be with them, and bringing back Shelton Benjamin, and pairing him off with American Alpha. Not permanently or like as a stable or anything necessarily, but more like aligning him with them for a program. They could have a bunch of six-man tags. I like that idea a lot. I really do. And we saw quite a bit of Carlito against Shelton, if you remember, for the Intercontinental title back in the day when they were in the company together. Probably 2005, 2006. So there is a history there between Shelton and Carlito. So I say, why not? You know, Shelton is cleared. He says he's taking indie bookings. He's made it very clear he has not heard from anybody in WWE. I think they need to fix that, and they need to make this happen. We got another Lana vignette hyping her debut. They are indeed going to be splitting her away from Rusev, it appears, which I don't like that. I don't like that. That might end up okay for her, but not so much for Rusev. Looks like they're giving her the Emelina gimmick that they abandoned ship with Emma. This week, she was sitting in a chair doing lots of provocative dance moves. And speaking of dances, oh my god. Did you see the video of Lana's new dance gimmick that she's been trying out on the NXT live events? You have to see this, okay? Go on my Twitter. Go on my Twitter. You'll see a link to the video there. I use the word dance in air quotes as I say that. I've seen people with vertigo and two broken legs with better moves than what I saw in that video. It is hilariously bad. Kevin Owens is now doing the Face of America Open Challenge. His first challenger was a local guy named Gary Gandy. He was immediately beaten with a pop-up powerbomb, and then Owens took a seat at the announce table to do some commentary for the main event of AJ Styles against Baron Corbin. Corbin hit a deep six for a near fall. They went out to the floor. Styles was going to go for a Styles clash. Corbin backdropped him right onto Kevin Owens. Corbin then set him up for the end of days on the floor. AJ rolled all the way through, landed on his feet, hit an enziguri to the back of the head. And he jumped off the steps, AJ did, for some added momentum with a phenomenal forearm. That knocked Corbin into the front row, and AJ made it back into the ring just in time to avoid the countout. AJ Styles gets a countout victory over Baron Corbin, and that is how the show ended. I am not a fan of ending the show on a count-out finish, but at least they didn't beat AJ. And that was pretty much SmackDown, all the key stuff anyway. It really was all about Jinder Mahal. That kind of overshadowed everything else. You either liked it because it was something different, or you really hated it. But these next 4 weeks, I think, are going to tell the tale as far as whether or not kind of heel Jinder in that position high up on the card really has any legs or not. There was no Nakamura on the show this week, which is fine. I didn't have a problem with that. He doesn't have to be on the show every week. Keep him more special that way. But there was some interesting news from Billy on the Dirty Sheets podcast, so credit to him, on what the original plan was for Nakamura's debut. In fact, he had news from a source of his on what was originally planned in a lot of different facets for WrestleMania this year. And suffice to say, WrestleMania would have been a very different show and probably received a lot better than it was had they gone with this plan. Now, he's broken some news recently, so I would not mention this if I didn't think there was credibility to it. The idea had been for The Undertaker to challenge AJ Styles for the championship in San Antonio at the Royal Rumble, with The Undertaker winning the championship. Undertaker then would have dropped the title back to AJ at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view after being eliminated by John Cena. Cena would then wrestle Undertaker at WrestleMania, which we've heard that from a lot of different places, that the original plan, the original idea was to do Cena and Undertaker, and then Vince changed his mind. So that would have been the impetus to do Cena, Undertaker at Mania instead of Roman Reigns and an Undertaker. And AJ, now with the championship back in his possession, would defend against Randy Orton. Randy Orton was always penciled in to win the Rumble. And so you would have had AJ and Orton for the championship at WrestleMania. Now, this all got changed. You're wondering, well, then what happened? Who got hurt? Or why did plans change? According to this report, this all got changed after Kevin Dunn allegedly pitched the idea to Vince about John Cena proposing to Nikki Bella at WrestleMania. And Vince spent the next several weeks pitching the idea to Cena. Cena was not sold on the idea. He did not want to do it. And finally, he relented. He said, okay. And as a reward for doing so, because it's not just a matter of, hey, we want you to do this proposal to her. And maybe Cena's, I mean, I know they have the reality show and everything, but I get the sense that there's some things Cena would rather be more private about. Whether it was a matter of that, whether it was just a matter of, hey, we understand that we're going from putting you in the main event in a big match against The Undertaker to wanting to put you in a mixed tag with The Miz. Whatever it was, they rewarded him for doing so by having him beat AJ at the Rumble and win his 16th world title. That was a reward for him agreeing to go along with this new plan. But it was not the original plan. What ended up happening at WrestleMania was definitely not the original plan. So if all of this is accurate, okay, we have Kevin Dunn to thank for things going down the way that they did. I don't know what Roman Reigns would have been doing at WrestleMania. Maybe, you know, wrestling Samoa Joe. I mean, who knows? I don't really care. Where it gets interesting is that also part of the original plans for WrestleMania had Daniel Bryan bringing in Shinsuke Nakamura as a surprise challenger for The Miz and his Intercontinental title at WrestleMania. So when the plans for Cena changed, so too did the plans for Miz and Nakamura, who ended up missing WrestleMania altogether. They just decided we'll keep him off and we'll just debut him on TV. That one really sucks, especially after, you know, if you remember last week after the whole superstar shakeup, I mentioned how, man, you know, WWE really dropped the ball with this whole Miz and Bryan thing, just dropping it the way they did cold turkey without any sort of a payoff, right? And I know they were never going to do a match. I'm not saying, well, I'm disappointed they didn't do a match. I knew that wasn't going to happen. But, you know, at least do one last face-to-face on TV or something. We got nothing. We got nothing. After months of teasing it and kind of building all this heat and all this friction between the two of them, they just moved Miz to Raw, and that was that. And the idea of Bryan bringing in Nakamura effectively as his surrogate to come on in and beat The Miz and take his title would have been a fantastic finish to their little feud, a fantastic little payoff if Bryan couldn't wrestle. I think that would have been great. So the WrestleMania card would have had John Cena and The Undertaker, Goldberg and Brock Lesnar, AJ and Randy Orton for the title, which is where Styles should have been, really, either challenging for or defending the championship. Triple H against Seth Rollins, and Nakamura debuting against The Miz as a surprise, and I assume probably winning the Intercontinental title. Plus you have the Hardys, who made their big return. See, now that would have been a lot of fun. And I'm one of those people who actually thought this was a good WrestleMania. I didn't crap all over it or anything, but it was definitely one of the weaker cards going in. But that card that I just outlined, that right there, I think would have been a winning card. And it's a shame it didn't go down that way. As first broken on Ryan Satin's The Sheet podcast, it looks like Mike Bennett and Maria Kanellis, formerly of Ring of Honor and more recently TNA, are on their way to WWE. And more specifically to the SmackDown Live brand. So if they have not already signed their contracts, it sounds like they're probably going to do so any day now. I think Marie is fantastic. I would be very happy to see her back. Bennett, I don't really have an opinion on one way or the other. I didn't see too much of his work on Impact. I did in ROH, the stuff with him and Matt Taven, and I thought they were good together. If they end up on SmackDown, I could see them feuding with someone like Ty Dillinger first, you know, right out of the gate, assuming that Bennett and Maria come in his heels. I could see that as kind of an opening feud and probably an easy initial win. Like right now, Dillinger is brand new to the SmackDown brand. He's racking up some wins. That's not going to last probably for that long. And so if they bring in Bennett as a heel, it's like, well, who do you put him in there first with, right? Maybe Mojo. Dillinger really is the only name that makes sense. So I could see that kind of being his first feud right out of the gate. Let's talk about Monday Night Raw. Monday Night Raw was live from Columbus, Ohio last week. Almost 2,700 votes from you guys. 68% thumbs up, 32% thumbs down. Raw actually beat SmackDown this week. Believe it or not. I saw that. I was like, holy shit, I feel like sirens and pyro should be going off right now. This is a big deal. Yet again, no Stephanie McMahon, no Roman Reigns at all on this show. So all of a sudden, it's becoming very obvious to me why this was a 68% thumbs up show in the eyes of many of you. So I'm sure without Roman, the Empire wept. They kept him off to sell the injuries from the attack by Braun Strowman, so that was a plus. And this was the Braun Strowman show, make no mistake. He beat up Goldust and R-Truth. He literally tossed Kalisto in the trash, which is a nice metaphor for Kalisto's career there. He had another really good match with the Big Show, and this time they did indeed do the ring break. Everybody thought they were going to do it last time, and it didn't happen, but they did it this time. This is the third time, I believe, we have seen that finish in WWE since 2003. All three times they have involved the Big Show. Once with Brock Lesnar, once with Mark Henry, and now with Braun Strowman. And I guess the message here is that Big Show is fat. Not as fat as he used to be, but apparently still fat enough to break the ring. If you dare try to slam him off the top rope, the ring will break. Now, I will say, of the three, best ref bump goes to John Cone for the match here with Strowman. This guy fell out of the ring. It looked like the ring collapsed on him. Okay, but he is still alive. He is okay. Booker T filled in on commentary for David Otunga, and he was fine. I'm just enjoying it while it lasts, because we've only got another 5 weeks before Otunga makes his grand return to Raw. Samoa Joe got a big win over Chris Jericho clean with the Coquina Clutch. That surprised me, given Jericho's challenging for the U.S. title next Sunday. But I was happy to see it. I continue to be impressed by the way Joe's been handled so far. I got some crap for that when I said that a few weeks ago. Like, well, what has he done? He hasn't done anything so far. He hasn't done anything. Yeah, but you know what? They could have brought in Samoa Joe, and they could have been doing a lot of things with him that would have made people very upset. And so far, he's been a pretty dominant force. I mean, he's not challenging for the title or anything like that, but he's... You know, he's engaged in one of the big programs on the show with Seth Rollins. They've got him aligned with Triple H, and he's racking up wins. He is racking up wins. He has yet to, I don't think he's lost a match clean yet on TV. It's not like they're beating him like a drum or anything like that. And it goes back to what I was talking about before. Sean Waltman's quote about wins and losses, how they really do matter. They do. They should. And in the case of Samoa Joe, he's been racking up wins, and that's more than I can say for some other people they've brought up. So, hey, you know, I'll take it. I am impressed by what they've done with Joe so far, and hopefully he'll continue to ascend. And at some point, I wouldn't mind seeing a Brock Lesnar-Samoa Joe match to headline a pay-per-view. I think at some point we probably will get that. But Joe, after his match, he cut a great promo on Rollins. Rollins was out there at the announce desk. And Joe said, you know, when I attacked you and I hurt your leg, that was just business. I was a hired hitman for Triple H. Triple H was my benefactor. But after what you did to Triple H and Stephanie at WrestleMania, he said, what I do to you next Sunday won't be business. It will be very, very personal. And Rollins stood up on the announce desk and said that, he reminded Joe of what they say, which is that payback is a bitch. It was the whole play off that. I thought that was kind of clever. There was a Miz TV segment on this show with Miz and Dean Ambrose that has caused a bit of a stir. Miz was going in on this guy like it was a work shoot, you know, talking about how, you know, you were drafted number one last year, and You know, uh-oh. Miz, by the way, said a dirty word here. He said the word draft. 10 lashes for you. But then anyway, he goes into how, you know, you wasted all of that momentum and you were barely a blip on the radar at WrestleMania. And he's not wrong. He was relegated to pre-show duty. Kind of was. Then he said the Dean's problem is that you're lazy and complacent. And as soon as he said that, I was immediately reminded of the Stone Cold podcast where Steve Austin said something very similar. In fact, I believe he used that exact word in reference to Ambrose, complacent. And it almost seems like there's a message being sent here. Or it could just be a case of Miz doing what he did so well on SmackDown. And he did it with Daniel Bryan, he did it with John Cena and Nikki Bella, where you play off of something real. And that was a very real subject of conversation coming out of that podcast last year. You know, kind of, you know, I think what he was doing is just blurring the lines between work and shoot. Miz has become a master of that. One thing I can say in defense of Ambrose is that Dean Ambrose busts his ass, okay? He wrestled more matches than anyone on that entire roster in all of 2016. He was the Iron Man in that company. Didn't go down with an injury. If somebody else did, he stepped in, right? Whether it was a live event or TV or whatever, he was the one who stepped up and took their place. And he may not be flashy, and he does some things that irritate the hell out of me, like that rebound lariat that he overuses to a nauseating degree, but I would not call the guy lazy. I think that's quite offensive. And, you know, if it's in-ring work that you want to focus on and not so much, you know, him wrestling so many matches and doing all this work for the company behind the scenes, you want to talk about in-ring work. Hey, Kevin Owens is the king of the chin lock, okay? And I don't see people calling him lazy. So I don't really get where the criticism is coming from. So I tend to think it's more a case of Miz just blurring the lines and trying to work some of that SmackDown magic here on Raw, which isn't a terrible thing to try to do. I thought Ambrose's rebuttal was really good. I thought he was very spirited in his response, talking about how I don't care about money or endorsement deals. I love broken bones and black eyes. And I swear to God, I thought he said black guys at first. Like, I was kind of half paying attention. I had it on. I think I might have been looking at the computer. And I heard that, and I'm like, wait, what? What did he say? I'm sitting here wondering, like, what does Renee think of this? Maybe she does too. Who knows? So they came to blows. Maurice hit Ambrose in the back with a microphone. Miz tried a skull-crushing finale. Ambrose slipped out. He went for dirty deeds. Miz slipped out. He rolled out of the ring. And that was the segment. This was the part in the show where they showed Braun Strowman backstage dragging Kalisto through the hallway and throwing him in a dumpster. Big Show came out of nowhere and body checked Strowman into a garage door, told him to pick on somebody your own size. Big Show is a giant hypocrite. He made a career out of picking on guys smaller than him. He's got a lot of nerve. So this set up a match between them for the main event. Kalisto, yesterday on Twitter, signed his death warrant and challenged Strowman to a dumpster match on Raw tomorrow night. I may have to do a funeral intro 2 weeks in a row here on this podcast. Poor guy botched the tweet, too. He said, "Monsters have weaknesses, Braun, and you are no monster. I challenge you to a dumpster match, and then I'll reveal the kind of monster trash you are." Monsters have weaknesses? You are no monster? What the hell does that even mean? Ugh. Kalisto can't get anything right. But don't be surprised if he wins. I think Kalisto's going to win this. I expect Roman Reigns back. It is the final Raw, after all, before payback. Kalisto gets a fluke win. Put some heat on the Strowman-Roman match. Strowman then wins at the pay-per-view, and that sets up a title match against Brock. Maybe in June. I just don't know if they can hold off long enough to make it to SummerSlam. You know, now I'm hearing rumors that Jeff Hardy is one of the names under consideration as an opponent for Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. That may be a sign that if we do get the broken gimmick, it'll be all Matt, and they're going to go with Jeff as a single. They'll break him off. Speaking of the Hardys, we got another Hardy Boys match here sponsored by that damn allergy medication with the owl Okay, this is not the first time we've seen this here. They even had the owl on screen at the same time with Matt in the background. They had a little owl in the corner, okay? You can't tell me that that's not being done on purpose. It's just, there's no way. I refuse to believe that. Speaking of the owl, there really is nothing new to report on the Anthem WWE stuff. Obviously, this Hardy Boys reunion tour can't go on forever. They would be nuts not to capitalize off all the potential that the broken stuff offers. It's going to happen. It has to. I said weeks ago when they first came back, very easy way to make him broken again, at least Matt, if not both of them, you know, is when they finally lose the titles. Matt just lapses into this great depression. He can't bear the thought of no longer being champion. He loses it and he becomes broken. Because they're going to have to somehow explain it to their audience who may not know about all the stuff that they did in TNA because they weren't watching TNA. Okay? They chant delete, 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 but that doesn't mean they know what it means. So they can tell that story all over again and make it their own and give it their own backstory. And dropping the titles could be the catalyst to doing that. And you know, maybe in doing so, in that match where they lose the titles, Matt takes a knock on the head. You know, they could do an injury angle and he's not quite himself afterwards. It would not be very hard at all to explain. It was Jeff Hardy and Cesaro for the first time ever in a singles match here on the show. They billed it as a dream match. I wouldn't go that far, but it was pretty cool seeing them one-on-one. Good match. Cesaro went for the neutralizer. Jeff escaped, hit the twist of fate and a swanton for the win. I've noticed that Jeff, since he's come back, and I noticed this in the video I saw from their appearance at Tommy Dreamer's House of Hardcore show, because the Hardys did wrestle last night. I guess at the 11th hour, WWE granted them permission to go do the show. But I've noticed that when Jeff hits the Swanton now, you know, before it would be like the back of his head, the bulk of the impact, most of his body would hit the canvas. I don't know if it's because he's just compensating because he's kind of beaten up and he's older now, but when Jeff launches himself and he lands full body contact on his opponent. And I'm sure that must suck for them. Probably knocks the wind right out of them. So he hit the Swanton, got the pin. All four men, Matt, Jeff, Sheamus, and Cesaro, shook hands when the match was over. I assume we're going to get Matt and Sheamus in a singles match on TV this week, probably with Sheamus getting the win to build to the pay-per-view. It is hilarious watching Matt Hardy float between gimmicks every single week. Like, one second he's doing all of his old Mattitude mannerisms, but then he'll throw a delete in there. It's like, he's stuck in some kind of gimmick purgatory right now. He's like caught between worlds. The Revival, who seemed to be well on their way to title contention, they were not on this show. Reason being, Dash Wilder got punched in the face by Hideo Itami at an NXT house show, and Dash broke his jaw. It's funny how people jumped all over Jinder Mahal for hurting Finn Balor, but I have not heard the same outcry for Hideo Itami this week. You gotta love that selective outrage. So he had his jaw wired shut. He's expected to be out for up to 8 weeks. Terrible timing for them, obviously. But you know what? 8 weeks ain't that bad. It's 2 months. They could presumably get these guys back on TV anytime they want to. I saw Dash already tweeting photos. He's back at the gym. He doesn't have to speak. He can't probably do much in the way of speaking. But that doesn't mean you can't put them in some kind of non-wrestling role on TV. I mean, they've done this for other people over the years. Randy Orton had the shoulder injury all those many, many years ago. He would break in with those, the RNN updates, you know, the injury updates. I'm sure they could come up with something clever for these guys. Let Dawson do all the talking. They're trying a new sports agent gimmick, it seems, with Titus O'Neil. He pitched his services to Apollo Crews in a backstage segment. He mentioned that Crews is about to become a dad for the first time. I'm sure he'll raise that kid well with a great work ethic with all the jobs that he's done. Titus is calling it the Titus brand. He gave Apollo his business card. He told him to think about it. So he's basically the WWE version now of Famous B from Lucha Underground. He doesn't have a cool phone number like Famous B does. It's also the same gimmick they tried with Abraham Washington before he name-dropped Kobe Bryant and got his ass fired. Hopefully Titus is smarter than he was. Alexa Bliss won a fatal four-way over Nia Jax, Mickey James, and Sasha Banks to become number one contender to the Raw Women's Championship at Payback. They were in Alexa's hometown of Columbus, Ohio, so she got the big reaction. She was about the only one to get any kind of reaction from this crowd. They were dead for this match. And Mickie James in particular, ever since she came back, I mean, is it just me or are most of these crowds just completely dead silent when she is out there? Even if she's making a comeback or doing something, you know, she was a babyface at first, now she's a heel, but it doesn't matter. She has just gotten the silent treatment from these people. And it's really sad, you know, and I don't know if it's just a case of them not remembering her or what it is. I mean, they did say that this was her first match on Raw in 7 years. But, I mean, her work is still solid. But I noticed it when she was on SmackDown, too. The only time she's gotten any real reaction since she came back was that TakeOver match against Asuka. But those people knew who she was. But when she's in there, more often than not, the crowd is quiet. Alexa teased a crossbody off the top rope at one point onto Nia Jax. Nia turned around, and Alexa was frozen in fear and opted instead to climb down. A wise choice. That was quite great. We got a few minutes of Sasha and Alexa, which I think is the first time we've seen them in the ring together that I can remember. They may have had one match down in NXT many years ago, but that was about it. Nia hit a Samoan drop on Sasha. Alexa ran in, dropkicked Nia out of the ring, stole the pin on Sasha to become the new number one contender to the championship. A rare win for the hometown favorite. That's not something we see very often here in this company. Finn Balor is back. He missed no TV, as it turned out, only the house shows last weekend with that concussion. He obviously passed their impact testing before the show. They still protected him, though. He didn't take a single bump here against Curt Hawkins. He was in there for about 30 seconds. He hit three or four moves, including the foot stomp, and that was it. So a very safe win for Finn Balor. Chris Jericho was doing a backstage promo when the Drifter drifted on by, strumming the guitar, and Jericho put him on the list. We had a backstage segment with Alicia Fox showing her box to Dana Brooke on her iPad. I guess this was from 205 Live the week before. Noam Dar gave her a gift box and it exploded in her face, splashed powder or cocaine all over her, whatever it was. You know, if this were WWE 30 years ago, I guarantee you it would be cocaine for sure. Now, I haven't been following 205 Live very closely. I watch a match here and there, but I have no idea what's going on here. Emma walked in. She told Alicia that Dana was actually laughing about it all week and showing the video to everybody, and Alicia freaked out and said, "I don't want to be your friend anymore," and she walked off. I've seen high school plays with better dialogue than this. Braun Strowman and The Big Show. They did it again. These two had a really good match. We had kip-ups, we had arm drags and suplexes, and they were busting it in there. They teased the superplex spot a whole bunch of times to build and build and build until finally they hit it, and the ring imploded. Referee John Cohn took this amazing bump out of the ring. Big Show laid there like he was dead. Braun laid there like he was dead for about 30 seconds and then slowly rose to his feet and he screamed a giant roar from Braun Strowman. Another real strong showing for him. You know, some people were complaining about them recycling the whole ring collapse finish again. You know, but it's been, what, 6 years, I think, since the last one? And it got a great reaction, so I would call that a success.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Bobby Roode opened the show this week on NXT, talked about how upset he was that the roster came out to pay tribute the week before to Shinsuke Nakamura. He said that Nakamura didn't leave NXT. I beat him so badly he tucked his tail and left. And this whole segment was just designed to set up Roode's next program, which apparently is going to be with Hideo Itami. Itami came out wearing a suit. He slapped Roode right across the face. Roode sold it. He took his suit jacket off. He rolled up his sleeves. He's talking trash. And as soon as he walks over to Itami, Itami gets him up on his shoulders and nails the GTS. And so it looks like that will probably be the TakeOver main event on the Chicago show. I believe it's TakeOver Chicago on May 20th. I think that's the same weekend as the Backlash pay-per-view. We had a backstage segment with Jack Gallagher and the UK champion Tyler Bate. Looks like I'm getting my wish. I was just talking about this about a week or two ago. One thing I want to see more of here on the new NXT. I want to see more of the UK guys. I want to see that UK title defended. And wouldn't you know, here we are now. We have a UK title defense on tap for next week. It's going to be Tyler Bate defending against Jack Gallagher. We had a segment here with Heavy Machinery. They were filming themselves in the WWE Performance Center. We see this quite a bit lately on NXT, people filming things in the Performance Center. So if you're in the Performance Center, you might want to have eyes in the back of your head because you're probably being filmed. Actually, I think they have cameras all over that place. You're being filmed no matter what. So they were lifting weights, and we see in the background Andrade Cien Almas is getting into it with Drew McIntyre. They have a little shouting match back and forth. And Almas challenged him to a match next week, so we're going to get Almas against Drew. Almas had a match here on this show as well. He beat Danny Burch with his Hammerlock DDT finish. Liv Morgan and Aaliyah beat Billy Kay and Peyton Royce. Aaliyah got the pin on Peyton, I believe it was, with a sunset flip of all things. I really wish they would have done what I suggested when they did the shakeup and drafted Peyton and Billy to SmackDown in the shakeup, because it feels like this feud with Liv Morgan has just been going on for 1,000 years now. With one little small break where they challenged Asuka for the women's title and they lost. It's like, what else is left for them to do, right? They seem perfectly capable in the ring as far as, you know, moving them up. Certainly more capable than Dana Brooke was, and she got called up. So I don't see any reason why they shouldn't be on the main roster right now. Main event was Ty Dillinger in his final NXT appearance against Eric Young inside a steel cage. Only the third cage match in NXT history. Samoa Joe against Finn Balor being the first and Nakamura against Joe being the other one. EY bled here in this match. We got a cage match with blood. That's the way it should be. That gets a thumbs up from me. Eric Young climbed up to the top of the cage at one point, delivered a huge elbow drop off the top. Which was only good for a near fall. Ty came back, hit the tiebreaker, but when he tried to climb out the door, or crawl out the door, it's hard to climb out the door, Sanity ran down. They slammed the door shut right in front of his face. Roderick Strong and Cassius Ohno ran down to even the odds. They got their asses kicked. Killian Dane somehow in all this got inside the cage. He entered through the door. I think it was a case where Dillinger was trying to escape over the top, but Alexander Wolf was blocking his way. So now Dillinger is on top. He looks down below. He sees Eric Young and Killian Dane. He says, what the hell? He does a cross body block off the top of the cage, wipes them all out. And then Dillinger crawls out the door for the win. His final night on NXT, and he finally gets a big win. Cassius Ohno and Roderick Strong pick him up, put him on their shoulders, and the crowd chants, thank you, Ty, as they fade to black. So a good feel-good moment to close out NXT this week. There is no feel-good moment to close out this review, though. There is a possible injury to one of the bigger names on NXT, and that is Ember Moon. This week, they had a bunch of NXT tapings for television over the next several weeks. And without giving away any spoilers, I'm trying to be spoiler-free here, Ember Moon was thrown out of the ring by Asuka at one point during the taping on Thursday night. I saw the video clip. It was very awkward because Asuka threw her and Ember, maybe because Ember is so short, she went flying like between the bottom rope and the middle rope. Like this Superman dive right out of the ring. And it looked like a real rough landing. There were people there who said it looked like she may have hurt her shoulder. She was crying. Now, WWE has not said anything. Ember has not tweeted anything since Wednesday, last time I checked. And she usually tweets almost every day, so that's, what, 3 or 4 straight days of no tweeting? So, fingers crossed, hopefully we'll get some sort of an update this week. But I'm without knowing any of the spoilers or anything, I'm sure that they were building to an Ember Moon Oscar rematch, whether that's at the next TakeOver show or some other time, I don't know. So for her to go down with an injury, if in fact she is hurt, would be terrible timing. So hopefully everything is okay. Let's get into your mailbag questions here. I got a whole bunch of them. You could email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from so I can include that if I read your question here on the air. We'll start with Edgar from Chile. His question has a minor NXT spoiler from the tapings this week about the direction of one of the performers. It's not a match outcome. It has nothing to do with TakeOver or anything like that. But if you are sensitive to any kind of spoilers from NXT tapings, then you might want to skip ahead. Edgar says, last week, somebody in your mailbag suggested that Melissa Santos could be the translator and valet for Andrade Cien Almas in NXT. You thought that that would be good for him, but bad for Lucha Underground. Well, it seems like they are doing something similar. At the NXT tapings this week, Thea Trinidad, the girlfriend of Austin Aries and former Rosita from TNA, started a storyline with Andrade. She is of Puerto Rican descent, and I guess she can speak Spanish. Do you think she could fit that role? I don't know until I see her in that role how she may or may not do, but yeah, I think that could definitely work as far as pairing, you know, someone like her off with Andrade, who can be... The idea with Melissa Santos is that she would be his personal translator. So not like ring announcer. I mean, that's just a blatant copy off of Alberto and Ricardo. But the idea is that she would be his personal translator because his English isn't the best. And, you know, they might make for a good combo. So, yeah, I mean, if she can speak fluent Spanish, then she may... She's certainly a beautiful woman. And she could wrestle and take bumps if they need her to. I think she could definitely work in that role. It could just be what Almas needs to help him, you know, just that much more. If I'm Austin Aries, though, I'm keeping an eye on Mr. Almas, okay? You know how these things go in wrestling, right? They start innocently enough, but, you know, shit happens. At least Big Cass, you know, he doesn't have to worry about Carmella. She's with James Ellsworth, right? I mean, it's Ellsworth, so what's he so worried about? Amay from Mumbai, India. Who would be the ideal opponent for Braun Strowman at SummerSlam if the match you predicted at the beginning of the year against Brock Lesnar happens instead at, let's say, Extreme Rules? Well, I know his name has been floated as a possibility for Brock at SummerSlam, but I think Jeff Hardy would be a great opponent for Braun Strowman. I just think, I don't know why, I've not seen them in the ring together before, but I look at Jeff Hardy and Braun Strowman, I picture that as a match in my head, and I think they could have a kick-ass match. I love those matches that Jeff had with Umaga, and I think Jeff and a bigger guy who can go, and Strowman can go, I think that could be a lot of fun. And if they do that, maybe then they do Brock Lesnar against, you know, defending against Seth Rollins at SummerSlam instead. Javier from Maryland, even though Hideo Itami has missed so much time due to injury, do you think there's a bright spot to it because of the brand split, particularly if he ends up going to SmackDown, as compared to if he never went down with an injury and came to the main roster a year, year and a half ago? What do you think? I actually think that if he ever does get called up, they'll probably make him part of the cruiserweight division. I think that's in the future for Hideo Itami. I think that is his ultimate destination. It's probably 205 Live. Now, if he goes to SmackDown, I think that might actually be worse because they already have Nakamura. And we don't yet know how far they plan on going with Nakamura. I talked about my one concern for him many weeks ago. It was the speaking, but also the idea that WWE has never really pushed an Asian star in any sort of really high, meaningful position in their company. And you can go back over the last 10, 15 years. You could probably go back even longer than that. So Nakamura really is the first, and we don't know how far he will go. Right now, we're in the honeymoon phase, right? He comes out. He's only made two appearances on SmackDown. His reactions have been tremendous, but that's two appearances. How are those appearances, how are those reactions going to be 3 months from now? How are they going to be 6 months from now? And how do they book him? You know, he went undefeated on NXT for a very long time before he finally got beat. You know, are they going to follow the same blueprint on the main roster? Is he going to, you know, be doing jobs to Baron Corbin? We just don't know. So now you have another Asian star who does not have what Nakamura has. Now, Hideo Itami is very talented. He's a dangerous man. I think for a smaller guy, he pulls off the whole badass aura very well. When he gets that look on his face, he's not a guy you want to mess with. But he is a smaller guy. He does not have the charisma that Nakamura has, or the entrance, or the theme music, and everything that makes Shinsuke Nakamura who he is and makes him an attraction. You know, Itami really doesn't have that. And so I don't know, you know, it's hard to say, you know, a second Japanese star on the same brand when they're trying to make, you know, make headway with the first one. I think that's bad for Itami. So the cruiserweight division on Raw may be his best bet, at least at first, right? See how that goes. He could always end up traded to SmackDown at some point. I do agree that he's probably got a better shot now with the brand split and the cruiserweights than he would have, let's say, if they would have called him up 18 months ago. Steve from Virginia, what do you think of Triple H's entrance at WrestleMania being more impressive than Seth Rollins? Steve Austin thought this was a bad move because it made Triple H seem like more of a babyface than Seth. What do you think? I don't think it made Triple H more of a babyface. I think it made Triple H more of a bigger deal, which I guess he is, right? He's one of the legends. He's been around forever, right? 14-time champion and all that. But yeah, I mean, obviously, look, Triple H is going to get his entrance every year, right? Doesn't matter what it is. Every single year, Triple H gets this spectacular entrance. One year it was the Terminators. The other year he was on the throne with the furry costume. This year it was the police escort on the motorcycle. It's something extravagant. There was a report last week I mentioned, you know, Randy Orton was at a Comic-Con type event or like a Wizard World Expo in St. Louis, talking about how he hated the giant sperm entrance at WrestleMania this year. But he also made the comment, Orton did, that he wants a Triple H entrance. Even Randy Orton, who's been around a lot longer than Seth Rollins, and he's a bigger star, arguably, than Seth Rollins is, even he is envious of the entrances that Triple H gets. And look, he's Triple H. What do you expect? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying these guys don't have a right to feel, hey, I want that too. And I don't know if Seth feels that way. Again, the question was Steve Austin making the comment about how it made Triple H more of a babyface. Again, I didn't see it as him being more of a babyface. I just saw it as him being more of a big deal. I don't even remember Seth Rollins' entrance, if there was anything special about it. I don't really remember, and that tells you everything you need to know right there. They probably should have gone out of their way to do something special for him, and they didn't. Maybe in their eyes, well, he was going to get the win, and it's more impressive because he beat the guy that has the big, spectacular entrance. I don't know what the mindset there was, other than it's Triple H, dude. He's going to get what he's going to get because of who he is. That's just the way it is. Antonio from Portugal, what's your opinion of Fandango? I think he's the most underrated star in WWE right now. What went wrong? Who for you is the most underrated star on the current roster? Cesaro. Cesaro would be my choice. He's always stuck in tag teams. It's easy to forget how damn good that guy really is. You get to see flashes of it every now and then when they put him in there with somebody in a long singles match, how good he really is. I still have not given up on the idea, by the way, of a Cesaro-Brock Lesnar match at some point. I don't even care if it's for the championship or not. I just want to see those two guys in the ring having, you know, like a 10-minute match. Fandango, they just gave up on him too quickly. I mean, that really is what it boils down to. The Fandangoing was a big deal for a while, and they just didn't capitalize on it the way they should have. I think he could have been he could have been a solid intercontinental level guy. Like a heel in the same vein as the Honky Tonk Man. Maybe a modern day version, kind of the kind of heel that Honky Tonk Man was back then, but with better physical gifts than Honky ever had. Isaac from London, Ontario. Seeing Low Ki return to Impact Wrestling this week and winning the X Division title got me thinking about his run in WWE. He won the second season of NXT, and I can barely remember them using him that much, other than an Intercontinental title match against Dolph Ziggler. What happened to Low Ki during that time that caused him to be released 4 months after winning the second season of NXT? I still remember him getting in that little dig, that little total nonstop action dig on one of those NXT shows, and Michael Cole, who was doing his heel shtick at the time, just going like, "Nice knowing you, you idiot!" Like, really, like, heeling on him for that. Now, that's not why he got released, but the story at the time, if I remember, was that he asked for his release. It was a mutual thing because he was unhappy. They really weren't doing anything with him. I believe he has since debunked that and said that it was their decision to release him because creative didn't have anything for him. So, yeah, the old creative didn't have anything for me excuse that WWE loves to give people. And the timing of his release was terrible because they let him go right before Christmas. So I don't think that was something that he asked for. I think that was the story, but I think he has since denied that. So there you go. I mean, you've got a talented guy like him under contract. He wins the second season of NXT. I'm sure he was not the favorite of WWE, but the fans liked him, even though they had him doing that nonsense with Lay Cool and everything that is cool about Low Key, right? You see him come out the other night, and he did this in New Japan too, dressed up like in the Hitman video game character with the suit and the guns and the gloves, and yeah, he looks like a little badass when he walks out there. They took all of that away from him in WWE. They tried so hard, and it didn't even work. Fans still liked him. He still won that season of NXT. I wouldn't be surprised if they did nothing with him out of spite and then got rid of him because things didn't go the way they wanted to. Would not shock me at all. Jonelle from Schaumburg, Illinois. I think they've done a great job of building up Asuka so much that the woman who finally beats her will be bigger for it. I know you've mentioned in the past that other than Ember Moon right now, you don't really see any believable threat to Asuka. What I would love to see is for the winner of the women's tournament to get a shot at Asuka's title and be the first to beat her. How would you book Asuka's first loss? So we're giving up then on the idea of Ember Moon being the one to do it, because I still think it ends up being her. Provided she's not hurt after what happened at the tapings this week. But I do like the idea of making that women's tournament a bigger deal by announcing in advance that the winner will get a match with Asuka for the championship at TakeOver in Brooklyn in August. Because I think the women's tournament, does it start next month? It's either next month or in June. So time-wise, it would work out fine if this thing goes 8-10 weeks. Yeah, you could very easily do that. The winner will meet Asuka in Brooklyn at TakeOver at the Barclays Center. You know, and you think back, the winner of the Cruiserweight Classic, they became the first Cruiserweight champion. The winner of the UK tournament became the first UK champion. There is no title on the line for this tournament. At least not one that we're aware of. So a title shot against Asuka would make sense. And with, again, if we're putting the Ember Moon stuff on the side and saying no to that, without even knowing who is in the tournament because they haven't announced yet, my vote goes to Kairi Hojo. She is one of the women from Stardom that WWE signed. I believe they signed her to a 3-year deal. I covered this on the Sound Off at the time. I would be shocked if she's not in that tournament. She is incredible. I watched a couple of highlight videos of her work on YouTube after I read about her signing. She was also one of the Japanese women they brought in to wrestle Pentagon on Lucha Underground. When he ran the gauntlet against the three Japanese ladies. She has, and I'm not even exaggerating, she probably has the most awesome-looking elbow drop off the top that I've seen since Randy Savage. How many people have done that top rope elbow as a tribute to the Macho Man? And none of them could ever do it as good, right? Bayley does it now. CM Punk did it and was quite awful at it. This woman puts all of them to shame. Those two and all the rest. She's awesome. And maybe that's the play here. You know, every person who they put in front of Asuka, she's beaten. She had the most difficulty with Ember Moon. She had a kind of, you know, kind of cheat to win, you know, if you think back to that finish at the last TakeOver show. But everybody they put in front of her, she's beaten. This would be the first Japanese star they put against her, and maybe that's what it takes. You know, another star from Japan who wrestles that same style to come on in and beat the crap out of her. I think I like that even better than having Ember Moon do it, now that I think about it. Kennedy from Castleberry, Florida. I heard you say a couple of episodes back that Umaga was not a good fit for the Battle of the Billionaires between Vince McMahon and Donald Trump at WrestleMania 23. If you were booking that match, who would you have put in Umaga's place? Well, let me just say first, before people jump all over me for saying Umaga was no good, that's not what I'm saying. It wasn't because Umaga wasn't a talented guy. I think Umaga was one of the most talented big men probably in all of wrestling at the time when he was around. But for a match, and this was always my criticism of this, even back then, and that was the first year I started the Sound Off, although it wasn't until many months later. But my issue was always the fact that here you have a match that's going to get mainstream attention, right? And non-fans to tune in. They see this cartoon character straight out of the 1980s. This Samoan savage with a bone through his nose. And, you know, he's like, ah, on. He's like, seriously, he's like something out of the 1980s. It just didn't fit. It did not fit at all. And there's Donald Trump standing there, and this is a big deal. And that Umaga character was just too goofy to be part of that match. Now, who would I have put in? I would have probably had Ken Kennedy in that spot. You know, he could talk well. He was a charismatic guy. I think he would have thrived in that role. And at the time, before he started getting hurt and pissing people off, he was a star on the rise. So I think he would have fit. If not him, you know, even Hardcore Holly would have worked. And if you don't know the backstory behind that, in his book, which is awesome, and I encourage you to go, whether you use our Audible link to get it for free or not, definitely check out Bob's book, The Hardcore Truth. But in his book, he says that Vince McMahon promised him the role that Umaga ended up getting against Bobby Lashley. Bob even put off surgery. I forgot what injury he had, but there was some injury that he was finally going to settle down and have it operated on. And he had to put the surgery off, because when they told him, look, we got big plans for you, he's like, okay, I'll put my surgery off, because he was under the impression that that spot was his. And then, of course, it turned out not to be. But I think tough guy, Hardcore Holly as Vince's enforcer could have worked out well, too. I think that could have worked. But, I mean, if you're going for newer talent, you've got Lashley on one side, you have Kennedy on the other. That's how I would have done it. Joe from Seattle, I'm stealing this question from the Masked Man podcast with David Shoemaker. If you could recreate the Steve Austin versus Bret Hart 5-on-5 Canadian Stampede match with the 2017 roster, who would represent Canada and who would represent the U.S.? That's an interesting question. I guess my question to you would be, do they all have to be from Canada, right? Do they even have 5 different Canadians on the active roster right now? They have to, right? Let's see. Kevin Owens. Sami Zayn is another one. Ty Dillinger. This is not my team, by the way. I'm just trying to figure out who the Canadians are. Ty Dillinger, right? He was born in Canada. Jericho wasn't born, though. He wasn't born in Canada. Actually, you know who was born in Canada? Jinder Mahal. Jinder Mahal was born in Canada. What a team that would be. Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, Ty Dillinger, Chris Jericho, and Jinder Mahal. It's not quite the Hart Foundation in 1997, is it? Yeah. Actually, you know what? Tyler Breeze. There's another one. He's also Canadian. Anyway, I would do it this way. I thought a little bit about your question when I pulled it. I would have Kevin Owens lead, let's call them Team Canada, okay? Bobby Roode. Or I guess it doesn't matter who leads. You could always have Bobby Roode lead. You have Kevin Owens. You have Bobby Roode, who, after all, he was part of a faction that was called Team Canada at one time. How do you not include him? I would want the Revival in there. I mean, if we're going with the logic that not everybody has to be Canadian, just like in 97, it's not like Jim Neidhart was Canadian or the Bulldog was Canadian or Brian Pillman. So I would have the Revival in there. And what the hell? Put Samoa Joe. So you've got Bobby Roode, Samoa Joe, The Revival, and Kevin Owens. So that's 5. And I would put them up against Kurt Angle, because you can't have a Team USA without Kurt frickin' Angle. And it's perfect, too. If Joe were to end up at some point in a program or working a match against Samoa Joe, which is very possible, they are on the same brand, it would make sense here to have them on opposite sides. In fact, that could be the reason that the Canadians recruit him for their team, you know, bringing in Samoa Joe. So, Kurt Angle, American Alpha, of course, to counter the Revival and, you know, partner with Kurt. Seth Rollins and AJ Styles. I think that would be a hell of a 10-man tag right there. Angle wrestling for Team USA really is the closest thing I think they could even get to the whole heroic countryman thing that they had with Bret in 97. And even then, there's no way. Let me just say this. As cool as this match would be, there is no way that this match would have the same heat that one did in the Saddle Dome in 97. That whole USA versus Canada program was so heated. Like heated in a way that you just don't see on WWE television anymore. I miss that. I can't tell you, if I had to think back, what is it that I miss most about wrestling? It's that passion. It's hard for me to put into words. When you go back to that period in like 97, which looking back was actually quite a great year for WWE. Maybe not always business wise, but there was so much going on that shaped that company in 97 that maybe we didn't quite realize at that time. But when I think back, 97 and 2000, those were two very pivotal, great years in a lot of ways, creatively at least, for WWE. But there was something about the product, there was something about those crowds that bought into it. You don't have that anymore, and I miss that. I miss that so much. But that, I think, would be the closest thing to it if you were to do that, you know, with those teams and have Kurt, you know, Team USA, rah-rah, all that kind of stuff. You do that match in the right city, and I think you'd have something special, right? I would do it in Toronto. I love that whole heels getting... I mean, I guess now that's commonplace. 1997 was ahead of its time as far as the heels being cheered. We see that all the time now. I guess it's not as special. But still, to have an entire team of heels kind of go in there and get cheered like these conquering heroes and have all the baby faces get booed, I kind of like that dynamic. So I would do it in Toronto. If they wanted to do it here, you know, I know Kurt's from Pittsburgh. I don't know that Pittsburgh is really known for having great crowds. So maybe do it in Philly or Chicago. Speaking of Philly, Tyler from Philly, if you had to choose three John Cena matches to show either a non-wrestling fan or a John Cena hater, which would you choose and why? Well, I'm not sure why a John Cena hater would want to watch three John Cena matches, but Cena against Punk from Money in the Bank 2011's got to be on there. Always best, I think, to show a non-fan a match with a hot crowd, not a dead one. And the crowd was certainly very special that night in Chicago. And the crowd in New York was very special for a one-night stand in 06 when Cena fought Rob Van Dam. I'd put that on there. I think people would be afraid for Cena's life watching that match back. And you need a third one. I'm going to go with John Cena against Brock Lesnar at Extreme Rules when Brock first came back and he busted Cena open in the first 30 seconds of that match. That match is unlike any WWE pay-per-view main event that I think we've seen even since, let alone up to that point. I remember just being glued to my TV for that whole thing. And part of it was it's Brock's first match back in all these years and what's he going to be like. But that thing was just destruction on a scale, you know, with a star as big as Cena getting decimated that way so early in the match. And we had blood, which we weren't used to seeing. I mean, there was a lot going on in that match. I think that would keep people glued to their TV. I think a non-fan would either be horrified or totally engrossed by that match. And of course, the Cena haters would love it, you know, as long as they turn it off before the finish. That would be my only advice. Ray from San Juan, Puerto Rico. I've been binge-watching WCW Nitro on the network. I love the Steiner Brothers battles with Harlem Heat, Public Enemy, The Nasty Boys, and The Outsiders. In late 97, Ted DiBiase joined the Steiners as their manager. Didn't make any sense to me. Any thoughts on the Steiners and their involvement with DiBiase? Well, you're not the only one who thinks it didn't make any sense. I don't think it made any sense. Ted DiBiase didn't think it made any sense. He's done interviews that have said the exact same thing, but he just did what they told him to do. But of course, it didn't make any sense. And the idea that not only are you putting, you know, the $1 million man in there as a manager for Rick and Scott Steiner, but as a babyface. They turned DiBiase, he was a babyface manager. You know how awful that is? What a terrible role for Ted DiBiase as a babyface manager. Very dumb. Joe from Nottingham, England. Take one wrestler from a past era, dead or alive, and team them up with a struggling talent at the moment. This old star will team with the talent. They could even win the tag team titles if you want. Then either the old star or the current star can turn on the other and they feud. Who would you choose? I like Bray Wyatt and Jake the Snake. And there's a lot of similarities there, clearly, between their styles. But, like, Jake in his prime, and I'm talking, like, Jake in his prime, as in heel Jake from like 91, 92. He was already past his physical prime at that point. He had a very serious neck injury. I think that goes back to when the Honky Tonk Man hit him with that guitar in 87. But as far as like his peak of just being a complete asshole heel, I love that Jake character from like late 91 into the beginning of 92. You take that Jake and put him up against Bray, and I don't know. I just like the idea of that. And I know it's weird to think of Bray Wyatt as a struggling talent on the roster right now, given that he walked into WrestleMania this year as the WWE champion, and he's wrestling for the WWE title on the next pay-per-view, but he's got this really nasty problem of cutting these creepy promos and then going out and losing almost every single big match that he's in. You know what? That counts as struggling to me. So I think Bray Wyatt counts just fine. I'll go with Bray and Jake. Ryan from Toronto, buy or sell on the better post-wrestling career, DDP with DDP Yoga or Mick Foley with his multitude of books? I think Ryan realized even after he sent the question in that he kind of messed up here, because this one to me is a no-brainer. I'm gonna buy on DDP and sell on Mick. First of all, Mick started writing books when he was still active. It's not like just a post-retirement thing. His first book came out in 99. The second book came out, well, he was still wrestling, and then he had that Tatum Brown novel. So that's hardly a kind of a post-wrestling thing. It started even before then, but you know, either way, for God's sakes, I mean, DDP, he's made tens of millions of dollars off of DDP Yoga. He's saving lives. I would say that trumps whatever Foley has done with his books. And I dare say Mick Foley would probably say the same thing. Although, not to diminish what Foley has done, he's also done a lot of great work with different charities. He's done work with that Rain charity, and Mick's done a lot of good stuff. But in terms of who's had the better post-wrestling career, I got to go with DDP. Finally here, James from Staten Island. Buy or sell on who WWE mishandled the most and could have done far better with? Batista in his 2014 return or Roman Reigns and his rise to the main event from 2015 until the present? Yeah, they really bungled Batista badly, and I know Batista hated that run. It was torture for him. I think they did the best they could in the end with it because, you know, reuniting Evolution, making him a heel, was kind of fun there for a while, but you know what? I gotta buy on Roman Reigns. I'm gonna sell on Batista. I think they bungled both of them. So then you start to get into, well, who did they bungle worse? I don't think that Batista would have been back for any great length of time. I think, you know, he still was gonna go off and do his movies, and he was gonna disappear and become a part-timer anyway. So having him back as a full-timer was like a 4 or 5 month thing. It was short-term. And you know what? Even though they messed up with him, in the end, Batista still helped put over the Shield. He was part of that whole thing, the whole Shield Against Evolution program. He got over the Shield. He took the losing fall also for Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania, which was a big deal. I think, you know, having Batista be the one to do that was a very big deal. You know, could have been Orton. Didn't have to be Batista. But he worked his ass off to help put the Shield guys over. And remember, the Shield are the guys that they saw as the future of that company. And so I think he got something out of it with Batista in the end, even though it wasn't perfect. Roman is their guy. That's not going to change anytime soon. And it's not getting any better, because Vince is very stubborn about this, and they've invested a lot in Roman already, and he sees in him something that tells him that this guy is going to be just a massive success, and I'm going to see this through until the end. And everybody else, you know, be damned. The problem is, they have not done Roman any favors, as you said, going back to 2015 and the Royal Rumble that year. And ever since then, it's just been this descent for this guy. And, you know, he goes out there, he gets savaged on most weeks by the crowds, and, you know, it's just, it's hard for me to sit here and say it's not working, because, you know, I guess he is still making the money and his merchandise is very popular. So when I say it's not working, it's not like this guy is a total complete bust. They've got him in that spot for a reason. If he really was a complete and total bust, he'd be out of that position at this point. But I think Vince is willing to absorb all the negative reactions and all the stuff that is not going well because of the stuff that is going well, and because he honestly truly believes that in the end everything's going to work out just peachy. And maybe he'll be the genius and we'll be all the dumbasses in the end. But they have not done Roman any favors. I've talked before about, you know, turning him heel and or making him the silent assassin. Remember we went through that period where I said all they need to do is not put a microphone in front of him. Because at the beginning, he was really bad. Like, some people think he's still pretty bad. He's far from the best talker they have, but he's much improved, I think, from where he used to be. But for a while there, it wasn't so much turn him heel. It was, okay, you don't have to turn him heel. Make him the silent assassin. He is silent but deadly. Get back some of that Roman Reigns we saw during the Shield days. And they didn't do that. They went through this period of months and months and months to a point where Vince himself allegedly was writing at one point his promos for him. That goes back to the whole suffer and succotash thing on SmackDown. Months and months and months of trying to make him out to be John Cena, where he would go out there and he would spin nursery rhymes and he would talk about Jack and the Beanstalk when he was feuding with the Big Show and all of this cringe-inducing stuff that did so much damage, and tater tots with Sheamus and all of that terrible stuff that he never should have said. And it did lasting damage. And it goes back even further than that because of the whole Daniel Bryan thing. And I think Roman was just collateral damage in that. And sort of all the anger and heat was transferred onto him unfairly. But they didn't do this guy any favors since then. And they've had flickers where they have done you know well with Roman, and that's great. That tells me that they have it in them to do that. They have the capacity to actually book this guy well, but by and large I think they've really mishandled him, and it's done a lot of lasting damage. That, you know, if he can recover from that and become the big superhero babyface they want him to be, that is beloved by most. I mean, you'll never be loved by everybody, but can you win some of those fans back? Can you win some of those men, you know, back who love to boo this guy whenever he walks out there? I think you can. I don't think it's too late. But I just don't see them do, because at this point, I think you're talking a heel turn. I stick to my guns on that, and I think that is the way to go. And I've said before, sometimes you got to go to the dark side before people start to see the light. And I think that that's what you've got to do with Roman. They're not going to do that, clearly. Not anytime soon. And so it's going to be more of the same. You know, this guy just lost his brother. I feel bad for him. But he's going to be back on TV this week. And, you know, it's going to be right back to normal. I think people are going to be right back on this guy. And it's a tough position for him to be in, because he can pass it off as, it doesn't bother me. As long as they're making noise, right? And it is, look, he's got a point in that when he goes out there, people are loud. Crowd is not dead. And if you are a performer, I'm sure you love that, right? You love having all that noise, but you know that it has to bother him on some level, because what did he do, right? What did he do to deserve that type of reaction? Well, he didn't really do anything. It really, really boils down to how they handled him. And if they want him to be the next Hogan, Austin, Cena for them, and he's already headlined 3 WrestleManias, now going on 4, yeah, you know what? I would say that they've mishandled him quite a bit more than they have Batista. Because Batista, there was never any expectation that they were going to bring back Batista and build around him as their top guy going forward long term. That's not why they brought him back. Even if he did win the championship, right? Let's say the people didn't turn on Batista and he went to WrestleMania and he beat Randy Orton. Yeah, okay, he would have held the title for a few months. And when he had to go do Guardians of the Galaxy promotion, he would have dropped it. And then he would have come in and out as needed. And you could have maybe gotten a couple of WrestleMania matches out of him. But that's not how things worked out. But Roman Reigns, he's the chosen son. I'd much rather mess up someone like Batista or some part-timer coming in than I would my would-be franchise player. He's the guy that you should be handling. If nothing else, you should be screwing up everybody else, but making sure that you protect this guy as much as possible. And they may think they are, but I think they've done just the opposite. And it's going to be very hard, I think, for them to get people to come around on him and buy into him being the one to slay the beast at WrestleMania next year, which I'm sure is their big plan. So anyway, that is going to do it for the mailbag this week. If you have questions, you can keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything you send to me, even though I cannot get everyone's question on the show. I do try. Do continue to support the show in any way that you can. Spread the word. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you can do so on thesolemonster.com. Get your shout out here on the air. Keep using the Audible link. Like I said, we're in the midst, we're very close to this being one of our best months ever. And you can cash in on that AJ Lee book. Audibletrial.com/Solemonster is the URL to use. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. I guess all this YouTube ad nonsense is still going on. I don't yet know how it's going to impact me. I guess I'll find out in the next few weeks. But nonetheless, I am still continuing to put content on YouTube. I will probably be doing a pay-per-view review as usual next Sunday. So now would be a good time to go ahead and hit the subscribe button if you have not already done so. We will be back with a brand new show next Sunday. That'll be episode 493 on our march to 500. So until then, be well, stay safe. We will see you right back here next weekend for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
Whatever happened to real men on this show? Can you imagine, in any other era of WWE, dressing down your top star the way that Stephanie McMahon did to John Cena on Monday night? They've done this with Cena. They've done this with Bryan. They've done it with Dolph. They've done it with Ryback. They did it with Rollins. Remember the infamous episode where Big Show was on his knees in the middle of the ring crying for his job? Tears are just streaming down this guy's face. This guy's 7 feet tall, 450 pounds. He's in the ring crying. He's a giant. Yeah, he's a giant pussy.
Solemonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solemonster sounds off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster sound off.